Hey, this is Kent here at MindChange, and we will be having a Q&R episode coming up soon. We'd love to respond to your questions in this audience-driven episode, so please send them to podcast@mindchange.com. When you send in your questions, please attach an audio recording of it, stating your name, where you are from, and then clearly asking your question for us. Please also transcribe your question in written form on the email when you send it in. We look forward to hearing from you.
Neurodivergence can be understood as both maladaption and what I was talking about before, rebellion, right? A rebellion against environments designed to keep us compliant, industrialized, disconnected from our true selves. That's positive, powerful, right? That's good.
Welcome to the Mind Change Podcast. I'm your host, Heather McKean, speaker and author of the bestseller, Mind Change, and creator of the Mind Change Method. Out of the ashes of my own healing journey, I became an armchair expert in the mind-body connection and the neurobiology of trauma. Using the methods we will discuss on this podcast, we have helped countless people transform issues that previously seemed impossible to overcome. Each week, we'll dive deep into the strategies, insights, and success stories that will inspire and equip you to harness the power of your mind, body, and spirit in order to create the life of your dreams. Together, we are changing the world, one mind at a time.
Welcome back to the Mind Change Podcast. I'm your host, Heather McKean. Before we jump into today's episode, please take a moment to like, subscribe, share, comment. And if you're on YouTube, hit that little bell there to make sure that you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. Something unprecedented is happening in human history. Our child's brains and bodies are changing so much faster than science can explain. Over the past 50 years, autism has gone from being considered rare, about 1 in 5,000 children, to now affecting roughly 1 in 31 8-year-olds. Autism and neurodivergence are skyrocketing. Today's episode might feel uncomfortable. It might challenge what you've believed or you've been told about autism and neurodivergence, but it's an episode I felt like we needed to have because the numbers don't lie. And what we've been trained to normalize is anything but normal. Think about it. A study in the UK noted that there has been a 787% exponential increase in recorded incidents of autism diagnosis between 1998 and 2018. That's just 20 years. This is going to blow your mind because it did mine. In 1963, that's only 62 years ago, the autism rates were 0.01 to 0.05%. So on average, 1 out of every 3,333 children. Now the rates are 1 in 31. That is a 10,670% increase. This isn't a trickle. This is an avalanche, and it has happened in just 2 generations, 1 or 2 childhoods ago. And yet we've been trained to shrug, to call this progress, to say that it's just better diagnosis. It's more awareness. Kids have always been this sick. We just didn't notice. Really? Are we supposed to believe that entire classrooms, once quietly contained multiple autistic, asthmatic, allergic, and depressed kids, but nobody saw? No, we've been conditioned by institutions and media and the medical establishment to normalize the abnormal, to call sickness health, to dismiss an epidemic of suffering as genetics. But genes don't change that fast. The human genome is ancient. The environment, physical, emotional, and cultural, has changed at a breakneck speed. That's why we're doing this episode, because the explosion in autism and neurodivergence isn't just about awareness. It's about our minds and bodies, how they're adapting and sometimes maladapting in a hostile system designed to keep us compliant, industrialized, and disempowered. This isn't just about autism. It's about what's happening to all of us. And unless we start asking better questions, we'll keep mistaking rebellion for disorder and systemic breakdown for personal failure. So, back to help break all of this down is my co-host today, co-founder of Mind Change, Kent McKean. So welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be back. I'm glad we're doing this. This topic specifically has been asked about numerous times, whether it's online, whether it's people sending in a message or an email or whatever else, or even with consults and just talking with people in general. Like, people want to know a lot of things, especially with Mind Change. Can Mind Change help? Can you work with Mind Change? And if someone's on the spectrum or this and that. So there's been a lot of questions. So I'm glad that we're doing that. And even more recently, I actually just had a consult this week where someone at the end of the consult was like, "Hey, so I might be on the spectrum. The people are asking, adults that are maybe more recently diagnosed often are asking like, okay, so what about this? And they're wanting some perspective. It really has been, as you said, with all of the stats, an explosion, right? This explosion of not only the data and the stats, but the amount of diagnoses, the amount of people that are coming into life or in any situation with like, okay, this is now the problem. This is the issue. This is the diagnosis. So I have some questions for you on this. Now I'm going to have a number of questions as we go through it, but there's a lot of people that would say and would argue, and I'm not arguing one or the other right now, but I do wonder what you think. A lot of people would say this, what we could call an explosion of diagnoses or understanding or inclusion or whatever it is progress. Like this explosion of like, oh my goodness, now we're recognizing what's really going on here. So some people would say, yeah, that's progress. Like we're doing better as a society to perhaps normalize it. I mean, even in media and movies, like there's always something there, even if it's like a historic thing, right? And so some people would say that it's not really an explosion, but this maybe this noticing of autism is the newness, but it's actually always been there. Like whether it's anyone on the spectrum or anyone that's neurodivergent, it's always been there. We're just now more capable of recognizing it, of assessing it, right? A lot of people would say that maybe we're more aware. And now because of that, there are fewer kids that are slipping through the cracks. And I guess that would mean that a lot of kids were slipping through the cracks before, like thousands of percentage of kids. I'm not sure. But the question is like, yes, the numbers are higher, but is it simply because teachers and pediatricians and other people are more trained to spot these things, to understand these things, to notice?
Well, that's the official story. But the problem with that is that the evidence doesn't add up, really, if we're really looking at the numbers. Now, I want to say we're not – obviously, there is good about sort of expanding beyond what we might call neurotypical. And I do think that what we are now referring to as sort of neurotypical has actually never been neurotypical. I don't think so. I think what we're talking about is fitting into the children who are the byproduct of the Industrial Revolution. I think that that's what we're sort of misinterpreting as neurotypical. So there is a part of this more conversation around neurodivergence that I'm all for, that's why I called it a rebellion. Mm-hmm. I think we're rebelling. I think we were meant to be rebelling against this sort of industrialized culture.
Can I ask you a question with that just to clarify? So what I'm hearing you say is is that this idea of neurotypical, we're moving more and more away from what would have been considered neurotypical from the Industrial Revolution of like everyone sort of conforming to sit this way, be this way, act this way, whatever. And over time, as we as society move further and further away from that ideal or that old ideal, that people who are still in maybe some of these formal settings, it's more obvious because they're not typical and like, I'm just going to sit still. I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to learn this way. I'm going to act this way, be this way, speak this way. So then we might call it something that's neurodivergent, but maybe as a society, we're expanding as well.
I mean, we should be. I hope we are. The unfortunate thing is I think we mostly listen to sickness. So it's funny that the rebellion's taking the model of physical sickness, the way that an emotional and mental sickness, the way that, I mean, that's fitting the rebellion into the industrialized world that we live in.
Okay.
So that's what I kind of want to get away from or question. We're not, what I do want to say is this isn't the authority. We're not trying to be the authority on autism and neurodivergence.
Definitely not.
Not at all. I like to ask questions. I like to find out if we're having a problem, how did we get here? And if there's something speaking up, what are we maybe not listening to? So that's the approach I want to take. So I think that to clarify, when I'm talking about autism, I'm less talking about the spectrum than I am what we might call a disability. Because the fact of the matter is people are struggling and there it's pain and it's struggle and it's disability for some. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I want to talk about is, okay, those people in that situation, how did we get here? Because again, when we look at the numbers, something huge is happening. And so where I'm all for expanding the version of normal and typical, just doing that and not looking at the avalanche and explosion of pain and suffering that we're seeing, especially on children, we're going to lose something in the conversation.
When you say pain and suffering on children, how?
These children who are being diagnosed with autistic, sometimes incredibly debilitating. Mm-hmm. They will never have any sort of normal function, mm-hmm. right? And again, we can take issue with normal if we want to. I'd rather take issue with the pain and the suffering and say, okay, could there be contributing factors? Could we go upriver of this and maybe start finding out, to quote, I think it's Desmond Tutu a little bit of like, if we keep seeing people floating down the river, dead bodies, let's go and find out where they're falling in, you know, rather than just dealing with like dead body disposal. Maybe a gory graphic analogy there, but that's kind of why I think let's just open a conversation. I know we've worked with, and we'll talk about this later, we've worked with people on the spectrum, people who see or maybe coming in, maybe they're not wanting to work on autism. They are autistic and wondering how we approach that. But we have had people coming in wanting to deal with autism.
Sure.
The disability of it.
We don't necessarily see it as like this thing that's going to hinder them in this area and this area and this area. It's more like, how do we work with that? Right. But then also like we'll get into all of this, but like,
yes.
Yeah. How we deal with that. And the reason we deal with things in a certain way is going to be unveiled.
And listen, when I started researching this, I was like, wait, what? I maybe lean a little bit toward conspiracy, but these numbers are there. I was like, I can't believe we're not hearing this full story out there. So that to me says there's something going on. There's some way that we are not looking at this in the way that we're supposed to if we want to make real change, right? So for me, I always like to look at the numbers. So let's look at the numbers.
All right.
very important. A lot of this information that I'm about to speak on comes from the National Council on Severe Autism. So really important to know, I am not making this stuff up. This stuff is well-researched. As always, I'm going out and doing a lot of work and a lot of research before I speak on a topic. And so I think it's important that we link that in the show notes. There's many other places that I've looked and people that I've talked to. So anything I will either reference or we'll link it in the show notes. But for sure, I want to link the National Council on Severe Autism because they have an enormous amount of compiled research. So just to get back into the numbers, I already mentioned this before, but I think it's worth repeating. Back in the 1950s and 60s, autism prevalence was 0.1 to 0.5%. So that's like one in 10,000 children. And today, depending on which study, it's about one in 30 children. So when we're looking at numbers of and diagnoses, these are unfathomable numbers. We do not see things like this, especially when the story out there is that this is genetics. That math doesn't math. That doesn't add up at all. So I found these numbers to be really interesting. So California, their Department of Developmental Services, they have the longest running data set in the US as far as, well, a lot of stuff goes, but for sure for autism. And their autism caseload has grown nearly 6,000% since the late 1980s. And that's even after they tightened eligibility in 2003 to try and slow the surge. So this is not diagnostic inflation. These are kids, real kids, real parents, real families out there who are dealing with serious functional impairments. And so if we get into the whole awareness argument, like, oh, the reason we're seeing so much is because of awareness. That asks us to believe that for decades, professionals somehow overlooked 1 to 2% of children with disabling autism. Just overlooked them. Not just quirky kids, but children with profound communication, social, and functional differences. I mean, that's simply not credible. So let me start at kind of like the beginning here as far as numbers go. So there's a gentleman named Leo Kanner. He was a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins in the 1940s, and he's the one credited with the first real description of autism as a distinct condition. So in 1943, he published a paper describing just 11 children who showed a pattern of profound social withdrawal, unusual use of language, and kind of the repetitive behaviors. Now, at the time, he called that early infantile autism. Here's why that's important. Kanner said that these cases were markedly and uniquely different than anything they had ever seen or had been reported so far. So in other words, this is new. Now, if autism has actually been affecting 1 to 2% of children back then, and like is not new as we're being told that it does now, then Kanner and every child psychiatrist in every country would have been tripping over hundreds of cases. But that's not the case. They weren't. And that was why his paper was so groundbreaking. It's because he found something that was extraordinarily rare. But if you fast forward to today, one in 30 children, that's normal. That would be normalized if it was one in 30 children. That's something that's not rare at all. That's common.
It's like one in every classroom.
Absolutely. Now, if that same rate had existed in the 1940s, schools, hospitals, families, they would have been overflowing with autistic kids. Yet, there is no official record of that. Not in census data, not in institutions, not in the training of psychiatrists, teachers, or pediatricians. mean, autism barely made a blip in the literature for decades after Kanner's paper. So listen, that makes it really hard to argue that it's always been there in these kind of numbers, but we just didn't notice, or the criteria has changed. I mean, the truth is, something has changed dramatically. And if you're looking at credible research, it shows that there began to be this meteoric rise in the late 1980s. So listen, we can see this in institutions too. So we're taking it from the, like, there's no recorded data in the pediatrician's office, in the classrooms, in child psychologists. There's nothing to prove what we're being told now. So let's look at it from another angle. In 1964, California had reported about 13,000 people with developmental disabilities in state institutions. Autism was just this tiny little sliver of that. Today, that same system tracks nearly 200,000 autism cases alone. I mean, that's, I don't know the math there, but that's like, what, triple almost? The amount of just cases in general, and now there's 200,000 autism cases alone. So if that prevalence had always been 2 to 3%, then we would see tens of thousands of elderly autistic adults in care. But we don't. They're not in the census. They're not in the hospitals. They're not in the nursing homes. They simply don't exist in those numbers. So what we're seeing, and this is so important, what I'm about to say, what we're seeing with the data we're given now is that people are going back and they're rewriting history from our current narrative. Now, and we're hearing it. So this is being done in medical institutions and the way that we're being told about this from a cultural society point of view. But this is happening even on the most basic level, right? So let's say if old Uncle Eddie was a little bit off, we now say, oh, he was probably autistic. Like, if my grandfather somehow didn't show a lot of emotion, well, now I'm going to look back and say, oh, he was probably on the spectrum. People are doing this, but they're not realizing how damaging it actually is. And so this is a phenomenon. It's usually called historical revisionism or presentism. And it's, I feel like this is what's majorly happening with this autism narrative that we're seeing.
Okay, but like, why? Like, why would people revise history as if that's never happened in the United States or anywhere else in the world? But why would we revise history on this kind of thing? Like, you know, why would people use presentism and go forth when it comes to autism specifically?
I think that's a great question. I think that it's because it serves certain needs or functions. Sometimes intentionally, oftentimes unconsciously, right? So let's just go into some of the basic reasons that people kind of unconsciously use this presentism, okay? So oftentimes it's because we're looking for moral clarity or identity. Doing this really helps people draw sharp lines between like what's right and wrong, by reinforcing current values or by condemning past ones. We see this happening all around us all the time. Another reason people typically do this is that it legitimizes social change, right? If we cast the past as backward, old school, like not effective, then it allows us to sort of highlight how enlightened and brilliant and more informed the present is. And we do that because it strengthens support for our current beliefs and our current movements. Another thing is it just simplifies history. It's easier to apply today's frameworks than it is to understand past people in their own context. There's less nuance, but it's more accessible. Right. And another thing is, and we see this, and this is very, very common, it's political or ideological use, right? Leaders, educators, the science community, the medical community, activists, they use this presentism or historical revisionism as a way to strategically reshape collective memory so that it supports present policies. Presentism isn't, it's like what we're doing without realizing it. And I think we're just jumping on board because I think the powers that be are doing this. They're doing this historical revisionism with the numbers. The numbers don't add up if you're really looking. And so because this is happening all around us, we're doing it too now, right? And it's being used, presentism is being used to dismiss the unfathomable increase in autism rates. But here's the truth. Even profound autism, right, the most disabling kind, has doubled in prevalence in the last two decades alone. That cannot, if we're just to simplify it down to the last 20 years, that can't be explained by diagnostic broadening. You don't discover profoundly disabled kids after the fact. So, yes, diagnostic shifts and awareness can play a role in some of the increase in number that we're seeing, but it in no way explains the exponential global surge that we're seeing. I mean, the data is overwhelming. This is true increase, not just a new label. And science's seeming refusal to acknowledge that, maybe insisting that it's all semantics, honestly, that's a kind of denial that protects the system. It is not protecting our kids. It's not protecting our families. It's not protecting us. The explanation sounds neat, but it doesn't hold up when you zoom out. Because, I mean, here's the truth. It's not just autism. Childhood illness across the board has exploded in the last 50 years. Asthma has more than doubled. Type 1 diabetes is climbing 2 to 5% every year. Food allergies that once were super rare are now so common that we have to redesign lunchrooms. Anxiety and depression in kids are at historic highs. So what, we're going to say that all of that is just because we're getting better at diagnosing it? Of course not. Like, something deeper is happening.
Okay. So it's clear, not just with, as you said, not just with autism, but with a number of things, like, it's clear that the increase is real, okay? Increase in diagnosis, increase in what we're seeing, increase in what's around. But if it's not just better awareness, as you're talking about, and if it's not just that kids were like hidden away or mislabeled for decades and decades and decades, or, you know, however long, it begs the question of like, what actually changed? So that's the question. Why are we suddenly seeing this surge? Obviously in the last, you know, 20 years especially, but since the 1980s, why are we seeing this surge?
Really, that's the heart of it. That's the heart of this question. Because if genes don't change that fast, and they don't, then we have to look at the environment. And I don't just mean chemicals or pollution or the fact that we don't eat real food.
Which, you know, all those things are true and real, yet.
Yes, and they matter. Mm-hmm. I mean the entire ecosystem that our children are born into, physical, emotional, cultural, all of these things have happened at a huge and unprecedented rate as well, right? So kids physically are hit with unprecedented toxic loads, plastics, pesticides, endocrine disruptors, this, like I said, the ultra-processed food, sleep, disrupted sleep, screen time, right? Really big thing is that their microbiomes are different than any generation before. But all of that stuff is a factor. All of that is a factor. So please hear me say, this stuff needs to be looked at, reevaluated, figured out. It is contributing, right? But I would say maybe even more, what is under our control right now is that emotionally, families are under chronic stress. Parents are dysregulated. Communities are fragmented. Attachments disorders are rampant because of the pace that we're asked to live by and the pressure that we have on ourselves as parents, as people, as humans, right? Culturally, we've industrialized not just schools, but childhood. Schools demand compliance, multitasking, standardized performance, nonstop evaluation, right? There's less structured play, if there's play at all. There's little to no nature, almost zero nature. And there's less space for nervous systems to find balance. I mean, let's not even get started on the fact that children regulate to a regulated adult or co-regulate. And so are we creating environments where teachers are regulated? It's a whole conversation. And when you put all that together, the thing is that children's brains are going to adapt. We do that. Hmm. We wire for survival in our environment. And I think children now are wiring to chaos. That wiring shows up as autism, ADHD, anxiety, depression. They're not random defects. They are maladaptive adaptations. They are the brain's subconscious way of saying, I cannot thrive in this environment, but I will survive however I can.
Okay. So I hear what you're saying about the environment and how there's, you know, there's a real, there can be a real threat there depending on, you know, what we're doing and where we are and what we're living in. But something that the audience or people might be struggling with in general is like everything around autism, are you calling this a choice? Because obviously kids don't choose autism. Adults, parents, you know, they're not choosing ADHD. So these aren't conscious decisions.
Yes, right. Such an important question. I'm so glad you bring it up. And it's really important, I think, for people to hear us say this. It is not a conscious choice. No child is developing in the womb, choosing to be maladaptive or wakes up one day at age 3 and thinks, you know what, I think I'm going to become autistic today. Like, no, that's not what we're saying is happening. What I mean is that the subconscious and the body are making choices all the time about how to wire, how to cope, how to survive in any given environment. They have to do that. It's actually good that they do that. It's imperative that they do that. They need to take stock of the environment and adapt to it or they will die. I mean, think of it like epigenetics. Genes are the blueprint, but the environment decides which switches get flipped on and off, right? The nervous system is constantly calculating, how do I adapt to this? How do I make sense of this? How do I survive in this? How do I get my needs met in this? And sometimes that adaption is creative, is superpower, is something that I think we all have the ability to do in good situations, not necessarily just in negative ones. For instance, hyperfocus, something that is often associated with autism. Hyperfocus, deep pattern recognition, a withdrawal from overwhelming social chaos. Like, those are superpowers. As long as they're not coupled up against them being debilitating, of us having a choice, that's the thing missing, right? See, over time, there is no choice because they become survival strategies. And those become rigid, maladaptive, and then disabling. So when I say choice, I mean the subconscious choice of the system, right? The brain says, I cannot comply with a world that feels unsafe, unpredictable, hostile. So I will wire myself differently to survive. Even if it costs me flexibility or health or belonging, right? Or normality. In that sense, autism and neurodivergence can be understood as both maladaption and what I was talking about before, rebellion, right? A rebellion against environments designed to keep us compliant, industrialized, disconnected from our true selves. That's positive, powerful, right? That's good. It doesn't make it any less real, but it does change how we interpret the explosion that we're seeing.
Okay. I'm going to hold you for just a minute because you've used a number of words here that, you know, I think some people in the audience may be hearing and feeling it might be dangerous. So you're using these words of maladaptive or rebellious in conjunction with autism. And so it would seem, I guess my question is, are you sort of like minimalizing the reality of autism as a disability, right? Because this is something that, you know, is very real. And in one sense, it could even feel to the audience like you're disrespecting people who identify proudly as neurodivergent or like, you know, not having a negative connotation when they talk about themselves in this way. So just want to kind of clarify some things there.
No, I'm so glad. And I mean, that's why we're having this conversation. It's such an important distinction. And let me be really clear. I am not saying that autism isn't real or that it isn't for some people profoundly disabling or painful for many families, or that we should see it as a negative thing, right? I'm not dismissing lived experience. What I would like to possibly have a conversation about, or maybe challenge, is the story that we've been told about what it is and why it's rising. Now, when I use the word maladaptive, I mean exactly that. An adaptation that helps in one way, but causes struggle in another. Like that, when I say maladaption, that's what I mean. I'm not saying someone's a mutant, right? Like, no.
Like it's a yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Right. We're not talking about like a mutant like phenomenon here, right? No. This is a superpower we have as a human being. It's the nervous system trying to solve an impossible problem. How do I exist in an environment that overwhelms me? And that adaptation, which is a survival mechanism, comes with trade-offs.
I think the word we were looking for is, we're not saying it's like a defect to the human or to the person.
Yes.
That's, yeah.
Yes. Not a defect. There's good reason for this to be happening. It's our mindset with everything with Mind Change, right? When I use the word rebellious, I don't mean oppositional, like in a moral sense, right? Being a rebel. I mean it in a biological and maybe even spiritual sense. The skyrocketing rates of autism and other neurodivergences. What if they're a collective mirror? What if they're showing us that the environments that we've created, normalized, chemically, emotionally, culturally, they're actually hostile to human thriving? I mean, what if the rebellion is the body and the brain saying, I will not. I cannot comply with this system, like without there being cost. So I don't think the danger isn't in questioning the narrative. The danger is in pretending this explosion is normal And if we just seek to simply reframe autism as a fixed identity or as a genetic inevitability, and we stop asking why so many children are struggling at the same time in the same way, that's not empowerment. That's resignation.
Yeah. And something that I think is really important for you, and I think in mind change in general, is this desire for continually growing, evolving, changing for the better, like helping the world continue to change and grow and become, right? And if we sort of just accept things, or like that we want to push forward and help people get better.
Right. But if we are being told that somehow this is getting better, that we're doing better by having this massive explosion of neurodivergence and all of these different things, and start catering to it rather than, and again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't support it's unfortunately hundreds of thousands of people that are in this state, not at all. I'm not saying that. I'm all for that. Inclusion and thinking more about this stuff and exploring this. And I'd love to start to see neurodivergence as like a superpower. But there are people suffering horribly, tragically suffering, that what if they don't have to? What if we could listen and grow and expand and change and get all the good rebellious things against the toxins and the chemicals and the systems of food systems and everything like that and pharmaceuticals, but not have to have it be debilitating? Like, I think that someone should be asking those questions.
Okay. So I think we can all agree that there's been an undeniable negative impact from, and we've said it again, the toxins, the chemicals, the food systems, pharmaceutical use, like a lot of different things there. But I would like to get into the mind change perspective, the mind change approach with all of this, and always emphasize, you know, what you do is you emphasize the subconscious. And so how does that fit in? How does the subconscious, how does mind change fit into what's happening at the trauma and programming level that could explain, again, going back to this rise?
Right. Because when we talk about environment, we can't stop at like our physical environment, just like the plastics and the pesticides and the pharmaceuticals. So yes, they're a major problem and they need to be addressed. But the deepest environment that we all grow up in is the emotional field of our families and our culture. And that's where stored trauma plays a massive role. Okay, here's what I mean. So every parent carries unresolved experiences, right? Fear, anxiety, perfectionism, disconnection, right? Those live in the subconscious mind and the nervous system. We were not taught how to process this. This isn't being modeled. There was a huge shift in culture when we become industrialized that's keeping us away from nature, keeping us away from our ancestors, keeping us away from movement, physical things that were, without people even realizing it, we're managing trauma in ways people didn't fully understand.
Like, we used to live normally. Now we're living abnormally.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what has happened is trauma's gotten bottlenecked in one sense. It's not being released. It's being stored. And we've got all of these other environmental factors coming at the same time. It's like poison from the outside, poison from the inside. Okay. So that's what we are talking about. So our parents hold on to these things because they're in these last few generations that are not as naturally releasing trauma as we used to. And listen, those patterns don't go away. Unfortunately, time does not heal all wounds. They shape how we attach to our own children.
Actually, I'll say time often passes down wounds.
We learn how to do them better and get them more deeply ingrained. Yes. Right? Like it's very real for us how very real we feel safe or unsafe. Even at the chemistry level in pregnancy itself gets passed down. So a stressed or traumatized parent passes down stress hormones, epigenetic markers, attachment cues to the child before the child, first of all, before the child even comes earthside. And then secondarily, once they're earthside, then it's before they're, when they're pre-verbal, they're downloading enormous amounts of nervous system feedback, tons that's wiring them at such young ages. So many of the kids now labeled autistic or ADHD are actually showing us the overflow of generations of unhealed trauma. Like their little systems are being wired to environments that are unsafe from the very beginning, not because their parents don't love them, but because their parents' subconscious minds are still running survival programs. And when a baby or child feels unsafe long enough, the subconscious brain makes a choice. Don't connect too much. Don't relax too much. Don't trust too much. And very frequently, that protective wiring looks like withdrawal, hyperfocus, repetitive behaviors, or difficulty with social environments, right? So I look at these undeniable numbers, these skyrocketing rates, and I don't just see a medical crisis. I see a generational trauma crisis. These kids are like the canary in the coal mine. Their minds and bodies are rebelling against environments that were disconnected, disempowered, unsafe, both physically and emotionally. And if we don't address the root of that, we're just going to keep treating the symptoms. We're just going to create a society and a culture that normalizes dysfunction and maladaption. And then the real epidemic goes untouched, untalked about, unnoticed.
Okay. So I need to play devil's advocate here for a moment.
Go for it.
Trauma, as you're talking about trauma and how it's stored and how we're suppressing it and it's just passed on and all of these things, trauma feels like a really broad explanation. Now, maybe 20 years ago or 25 years ago, it wouldn't have felt like a broad explanation, but everyone uses the word trauma now. And so we know that autism is a neurological condition. I mean, you can literally see differences in the brain. So between someone that would be deemed as autistic and someone who would be deemed as not autistic. So there's clear differences in the brain there. So my question for you is, isn't it a little bit of a stretch to say that stored trauma explains those neurological, biological differences?
Such a good question. And one of, honestly, the biggest misunderstandings in the conversations that we hear about trauma. People assume, even medical professionals, even psychiatrists, feel that trauma is a feeling or an emotional memory. But what people need to understand is trauma is a biological event. When an experience overwhelms us and we don't resolve it, the mind and body store it. Stress hormones stay elevated. Immune responses shift, right? Neural pathways get locked into survival mode. So over time, unresolved trauma doesn't just live as a story in the mind. It begins to reshape our actual physiology, right? Epigenetics shows this clearly. Stress doesn't just affect the person who experiences it. It alters which genes get switched on and off. And then those changes can be passed to the next generation. I mean, I've talked about this numerous times, and there's a lot of people out there right now trying to like debunk epigenetics. There's too much study, like too much has already been done to show the connections. I mean, studies show that grandchildren of Holocaust survivors carry epigenetic markers of trauma. Babies born to mothers with high cortisol in pregnancy often have heightened stress reactivity themselves. So when I say trauma, I mean, I'm talking about pregnancy environments where stress chemistry literally rewires the developing brain. Attachment environments where an infant's nervous system is tuning into parents' unresolved fear, rage, or like numbness, dissociation. Like generational environments where epigenetic flags from or tags from grandma's trauma are still influencing a child's neurodevelopment today. So listen, if you put that all together with modern toxins, food systems, cultural disconnection, and you like put that all together in the blender that we have currently in our environment, in our culture, you get a neurological epidemic. It is. You're right. It's neurological. We can see it. We can see it under MRI, right? We can look at these things and see that the brain has been affected, but it's not random. It's the logical outcome of unresolved trauma layered onto an already hostile environment. So, no, I don't think it's a stretch. I actually think trauma is the missing link. It's the bridge and trauma, the way that we talk about it. So I'm not talking about go to talk therapy and get this all worked out. There needs to be subconscious rewiring of the way the subconscious was wired maladaptively in the first place. I think that this is the bridge between experience, environment, and biology. And to me, that's why the autism explosion makes sense. When you stop looking for a single gene and you start looking at humans as a whole mind-body system, I feel like we get answers, real answers that match the numbers. Hmm.
So another thing that I hear a lot in terms of all that you're talking about is people say these kind of labels, right? Or they use these kind of labels. Whether it's autistic, ADHD, neurodivergent. And sometimes when people are using those labels like for themselves, it can feel for them empowering. Mm. And for a large number of people, it's almost like they've finally been able to like language or have language or identity for like who they feel that they are or what's happening in their life, mm-hmm. the reasons why they think the way they do or act the way they do or whatever it is. And so oftentimes people who use these labels can feel community and identity and even like pride, right? And so wouldn't you say that that is a good thing if they're feeling the empowerment and the pride around like, oh, this is me?
I get that completely. And it's not a new model. It's one that I did personally when I did chronic illness, is having the label at times felt like such a relief. Like, okay, finally I have an answer. Finally, all these ways that I'm broken make sense. Like I finally have this identity of why all these things are wrong with me, right? There's a reason why my body's doing this, or a reason why I experience the world this way. and like relief and community and answers, like I'm not going to take away from that. That can be beautiful. But I watched this happen in chronic illness land. Was once I got diagnosed, and I talk about this often, that Lyme disease was my big, was like the straw, because the communities that I was involved with in the Lyme community were, yeah, it was a, it's an identity. It's a system that you get into, and you at first feel like, oh, thank goodness. But then it's like, and then it was almost like a template for how much worse I was going to get. And over time, what initially felt like a relief and a connection, over time felt like an identity. And I did not, and I will tell you, having a chronic illness identity does not serve you. So having a brain divergent identity in the long run doesn't serve you. Now, community can be beautiful, and it is, and it should be. But I've watched this happen in so many other ways, and this is where it gets dangerous, because labels become endpoints instead of starting points. They can morph from being a description into being a destiny. And when that happens, people actually stop being curious. They stop seeking, they stop growth, and frequently that stops healing. And I've seen this, I saw that with myself, and then I saw this with clients over and over and over again. Once the label is in place, then it becomes like a subconscious permission slip of, and like, and a future, like a written out future for this is the way your life is going to be. And it becomes this like, okay, well, I can't change this. This is just who I am. Or parents saying like, this is my child's identity, so we shouldn't even try to shift their experience. I know that that's what the world is telling us right now, but that isn't empowerment. Again, I think it's resignation dressed as empowerment. And culturally, labels like neurodivergent versus neurotypical, I feel like that creates a false binary. Like, honestly, it's doing the exact thing that we're saying we're not doing. It makes it sound like there are two fixed species of humans. Like, you're either neurotypical or you're neurodivergent. There's two ways to go. In reality, every brain is adaptive, fluid, and shaped by experience.
Can I be so bold as to say that every brain in and of itself is neurodivergent from another brain, because they're not all identical?
Yes. And certain experiences are going to cause one brain to do one thing and another brain to do another based on the internal wiring.
What they're holding.
And that the reality of that person. So the spectrum that we talk about is real, but it's not fixed. It's a moving target. It's influenced by trauma, environment, belief systems, and our subconscious programming. So yes, I totally get it. Labels can be validating, but they can also be get out of jail free cards that are not actually helpful. They can be excuses to stop questioning why our environments are producing so much suffering. And it makes people sometimes stop asking whether change is possible. And from a mind change perspective, I feel like that's the most dangerous thing of all, when we stop believing the mind can change.
Okay. So this is where, well, actually, I was about to say, this is where some listeners may be upset. It may have started like 2 minutes in. Like,
if you're still with us, we can yet upset you. No, okay. That's not our intention.
But if, okay, going back to all of the labeling, like if autism is part of someone's identity,
sure,
and it is part of who they are, then everything you're talking about and what I've said too of like healing or getting better or like these kind of things, it can sound very offensive, almost like we're saying that they shouldn't exist as they are, or there's a problem with you and you shouldn't exist as you are. So how do you respond to that?
So I feel like I hear that concern all the time. I understand it, and I'm validating that concern. But it's really just, it's such an important distinction. When I talk about healing, I'm not talking about erasing a person's uniqueness or saying that their identity is invalid. Healing is not about forcing people into a mold of what society says is normal, right? What I'm talking about is removing the trauma, the fear, the subconscious wiring patterns that keep someone locked into suffering. It's the suffering, not the uniqueness that we're addressing. For an example, if a child can't sleep through the night, can't digest food properly, or melts down in overwhelming environments and lives in constant stress, like, should we just say, well, that's autism, nothing can change? Or should we ask, like, what if there's unprocessed trauma? What if there's subconscious wiring? Like, what environmental overwhelm might be contributing to this, and can we shift it? Like, I believe that autism isn't just one thing. It's a spectrum of adaptations. And while someone's gifts, see, this is where it gets tricky. There's a lot of gifts in this. There's a lot of what I like to call superpowers that I think every brain is capable of for different reasons. Okay, I'm going to use this. Something that bothers me so much is these posts and these people that say, my trauma made me who I am today. Like, I wouldn't be this great mother, this great speaker, this great business person, this great thing if I wouldn't have gone through all the trauma. Mm-hmm. That makes me mad. Because what that person's saying without realizing it is that the only reason that I'm good is because of all the suffering that I went through. And I think, excuse the expression, but screw that. That's mean. That's not nice. That's gross that you're going to take this beautiful, wonderful, innocent child, human being brought into this world, and you're going to be like, ooh, the only way you get to be special is horror, terrible things, awful things, and then you can be good. Honestly, I feel like that's the conversation that we're all having inside of our brains anyway. It's just dressed up to look nice. I don't think that's cool. So I think that this is a little bit like that, is that we have these gifts, these really beautiful gifts like pattern recognition and creativity and deep focus that might be part of who somebody is. But the suffering that comes from that isn't their essence. The suffering is the maladaption, right? And the good news is maladaptions can change because the subconscious can change. So when I talk about healing, always, I'm talking about liberation. I'm talking about giving someone the freedom to live without layers of trauma, fear, disability that's making them stuck, not erasing the person. In fact, I would say the opposite. I would say helping the true self shine, like the true being, the truest form of someone to shine through without being buried under maladaptive wiring.
Okay. So then we've talked a lot about a lot of things. Talked a lot about like theory and history and how and all of these different things and the surges. Let's get practical for a moment.
Great.
So if this explosion, this uptick, this whatever of autism and neurodivergence is, as you're saying, really about maladaptive adaptations to whether it's hostile environments or stored trauma, then what does healing actually look like? What can families who are listening to this, and maybe they have a child with autism, or maybe an individual is listening to this and they are noticed they're on the spectrum of this or that or neurodivergent, like, give me some practicals here.
That's great. And honestly, that's the heart of this conversation, right? I really want to leave people with hope. Healing isn't about curing someone in the medical sense. It's about rewiring the subconscious mind.
Can I actually say one thing about that? I really appreciate that you said that, because like, if there's anything that we really want people to make sure is highlighted in all of this that we're talking about, is this isn't about like curing, like you said, autism, or like this, it's not about like this, there's something wrong with you and we have to cure it. It's
right. That's a medical model.
Right. This is like obviously working with, getting, you know, deeper into understanding the how this was formed, all of this. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight that this is like, this is about, okay, what can we do from here?
Yeah. It's really about, wiring the nervous system. Because when we're talking about neurodivergence and autism, and we talk about any struggle that comes along with it, it's often we're talking about nervous system stuff. So what we want to be doing is taking the nervous system out of survival mode. And that way we keep the superpowers and lose the struggle. Hmm. Right? Now, this would be, I think this is a great place to let you share a little bit. We've worked with a number of people who have an autism diagnosis.
Yeah.
And even more and more and more now who claim neurodivergence. So like, maybe you can give us some anecdotal story.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the first thing I'll say is I'll give you one story. There, you know, someone I worked with, they're autistic. Not so much of like the, oh, I have a little neurodivergence, like definitely some like obvious autistic tendencies. And one of the things I had to explain to the parent, and this is an adult, but one of the things I had to explain to the parent of this adult, is like, there's nothing wrong with them. Like, that's the first thing. And this is what we want everyone to know in anything that we're talking about, is autism, neurodivergence, ADHD, depression, you know, like addiction, like whatever what you would maybe see as a problem, like there's nothing wrong with that person. They are wired exactly. They're living out exactly how they're wired.
Yes.
So they're actually functioning perfectly. Oftentimes someone may not be not be functioning optimally the way they want to.
Right.
And that's where we can step in and help. And so that's the first thing that I want to say, is like, when I have worked with multiple people that from themselves say, oh, I'm autistic, or these are my, maybe they call them limitations or whatever. I was actually working with someone about a month ago who, one of the things I really had to say even to their partner was like, some of the struggles that they were having as a couple because of this, I had to just say, okay, so what is this like for you, the person without autism? That, what do you believe about? Like, well, is that, and they're just saying like, how, you know, I know that this is the way they are and this is how they'll respond, and I have to kind of just decide to live with this. And I was like, whoa, hold on just a second. And I asked the other person, like, so what happens inside of you when you hear this? And after some kind of like superficial answers I got from the person who is on the spectrum, that it's like actually really sad to hear someone say this about them. And I was like, that's it right there. Like, there's nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong. But what can we do to help optimize the relationship? What can we do to help optimize the skills of how their brain works in a certain capacity with school, with work, with whatever, right? And so that's what I'm about when I'm working with someone who, and honestly, this is also what I've found, is like, people who do see themselves a little bit more as, whether they would claim neurodivergence or the label of autism or on the spectrum or whatever you want to call it, people who kind of like There are people who have gone to a medical professional and been diagnosed with these different tests and different things. And then there's people who maybe just claim it a little bit of like, oh, I think this is probably about me. Regardless of what is there, our intention or my intention when I work with someone is like, okay, so for you, what do you believe is holding you back because of the belief system around the autism or the neurodivergence, or like what is holding you back and what can we do to deconstruct whatever that thing is that's holding back your nervous system, holding back your ability to function in a way that you want to function in this scenario or that scenario, whatever it is. And that's what we go after in the same way that I would with someone who is not claiming autism or neurodivergence. Like, what's the thing that's holding you back? And what happens inside of you and what's going on? Like, okay, now we're just going to go in to those subconscious programs, how they were input, how they were wired, and we're going to work with that. Now, of course, I'm talking about people who would be considered high functioning autistic, right? Because then, of course, you know, when I actually, a couple of decades ago, I actually worked with children, nonverbal children with autism that were, it's like, you need to monitor them all the time. Like they'll hurt themselves or they'll, you know, things like that. And it was a really beautiful experience actually for me to like be there with them. So, but what I'm talking about is when people come in specifically and they are at a level where they are verbal and able to communicate and able to, you know, go to these different places that we're asking them to go in the work. But yeah, I mean, I think that the biggest thing, what I would say the biggest victory is in every person that I've worked with that has, again, either kind of self-identified or been identified as autistic, the thing that I like love more than anything is when they recognize inside of them that like they are beautifully made and that they are perfect just as they are, and that those, honestly, the building blocks, the negative building blocks of what often can happen with a child who has been dealing with autism from a young age onward is there's going to be a lot of outside shame, a lot of outside, like, just you can't do this or what's wrong with you, or, you know, there's just going to be things or like self things of frustration of like, I can't get this and everyone else seems to be getting this aspect. Helping liberate them from that is probably my favorite part of that work, is because like it goes down to how they view, value, feel, and live about themselves, for themselves, and how they go into this world differently, knowing, oh my goodness, there's nothing wrong with my brain. My brain is so powerful. My life is so powerful. Like I can, whatever, I can keep going, but yeah. that's sort of.
Well, and I think what society is trying to do is get to that point, but skip the work. Mm. They're like, let's just accept people and tell people and do this. But what they neglect is that a lot of suffering comes with these diagnoses. Mm. So if we can do the work, listen, it's wiring. I think almost everybody would agree with that. It's wiring. It's the way the brain functions. It's the way the mind works that gives us this diagnosis or this, you know, definition of neurodivergence or autism, right? Mm. That happened unintentionally for everybody.
Yeah.
So let's get in and get intentional. Like if it changed that way because of the wiring and we've got these results happening, well, hey, let's get in and mess with the wiring a little bit more intentionally with, you know, with power and see what else we can do in there. We're just working with the same system.
Yeah.
Okay. Just pause for a quick disclaimer, because let's say someone is like tracking with what we're saying. What I want to just warn people about is if you've got a child with autism or who's on the spectrum or is neurodivergent, what we are not saying is it's all your fault and you passed down all your unprocessed trauma and that's why your child is this way. Okay. That is not what we are saying at all. What this is an invitation into, hey, I'm sure you do a ton of other things to support your family, your child in what this means. How about also just get into your own work about this? Like, is there anything in you free yourself from any possible contributors? Because then you can see clearly what is possibly your contribution to the whole thing and what's maybe ancestral, what's uniquely theirs. And it really helps highlight what can be done if anything can be done. So I think it's really about freedom. So it is not about ever, ever, ever. Mind change is never about blame, guilt, or shame.
Yeah. And I will say, even like with all of the emotional driver series, you often will bring up like, if you grew up in a family with this, and it's not about like, oh, identify this so that you can then blame, or it's their fault and I'm this way because, right? It's about perhaps identifying some things and then stepping into that ability to liberate yourself, your past, your family, your whatever else. And can I just add one more thing? One of the things that was, I think, one of the most beautiful aspects of when I've worked with people who have, been neurodivergent, autistic, whatever, somewhere on the spectrum. Actually, what's been beautiful, I can think about one, two, like off the top of my head, I can already think about three people who were like, definitely, you know, there's an obvious autism there. Three of those people that I can think of off the top of my head that I've worked with, what was so beautiful is that their family also did the work. Mm-hmm. And these are adults. Like, I'm not talking about children I worked, like, these are adults, but their family, kind of everyone was on board of like, how can we best support you and like ourselves in all of this? And so what's really been amazing is to watch some of the family life, which is then the broader life of people who they end up doing the work as well. And they have a whole different view, feeling about themselves, about autism, about their child, about their partner, about their friend, about their whatever. It's like everything is elevating. Everything is liberating because each person is doing their own work first. And so anyways, it's about liberation.
And that's really the story of mind change is like, it's not about, oh no, I did this to my kids. You know, often I know that sometimes can be the negative voice in our minds that can do that to us. But it's really about having an opportunity to do for our families, for ourselves, what our parents didn't have the opportunity to do. You know, if I can influence the next generation in a positive way, let me do that. Let me try. That's kind of my mantra of it is I already know that there are going to be things that I pass down that probably wish I wouldn't have, right? Like
right here, I'm with you.
Yeah. Like, oh darn, that's what that looks like when I didn't resolve it. I just coped around it. And that's what it looks like in my children. Absolutely. But I don't want that just to be done. Like, there's stuff I can do about that. There's stuff I can do about the way I feel about that that might change it for the way my child feels about it, which might then eradicate it for my grandchild. So it's just about let's do what we can, right? So like, what does that mean in practicality? Yeah. So like we get in and we uncover root experiences, subconscious moments where maybe the brain decided the world isn't safe, or it's safer to withdraw or shut down, or if I hyper focus on this, I won't see or feel all the other hard things that are going on around. We're really looking to rewire so that the nervous system no longer reacts as if they are in danger presently, right? It's freeing the body by freeing the mind of generations of trauma chemistry so that sleep is addressed. Digestion, regulation, resilience can return. You know, we're looking to create with intention a new environment in the mind. Curiosity, connection, safety. And I believe that we structured the Mind Change Method to tick all of these boxes, to make it accessible, make it user-friendly, you know, for those who will take the time to relearn and return to a healthy baseline, right? To work with the way that we're designed, not against it. And the most important piece is, like you spoke to, this isn't just about an individual or about a child, a problem with a child. We see this all the time in all sorts of issues. Families who do this work often find their own trauma patterns shifting. And that when parents heal, kids often respond. When kids heal, parents soften. It's systemic. Just like disease, healing is systemic. And healing feels like and looks like freedom. Not freedom from uniqueness or superpowers or all the different divergent ways that we can be, but freedom from unnecessary suffering. I think that's the real revolution. Because if the autism explosion is a mirror of our broken environment, which I think it is, then every step toward healing is also a step toward rehumanizing the world that we've built.
Great. So we've talked about a lot of things here, but can you maybe sum up all that we've talked about and maybe give some takeaways for people who, you know, after hearing all this, maybe they're feeling a little overwhelmed, or maybe they're, you know, I don't know, that like, oh, the rise in autism and what do I do? And maybe just, you know, give us a little bit of what to take away from it.
Great. Okay. The biggest takeaway would be this. The autism explosion isn't actually a mystery, and it's not just genetics. I feel like it's a mirror. It's showing us that the environments we've created, physically, emotionally, and culturally, are breaking down our children's minds all around the world, and their bodies are adapting in ways that look like disability. But underneath, they are survival strategies. That doesn't mean that nothing can change. It means the opposite. Because if the subconscious can wire itself into maladaption, it can rewire itself out. Trauma is not a destiny. Labels are not endpoints. And the mind is never stuck. So healing is possible, not by erasing uniqueness, but freeing people from layers. So here's the challenge to the listeners. Don't accept this story as the new normal. Don't let labels become an endpoint. I think come with us. Ask the deeper questions. Let's look at environments. Again, not just the environments around us, the environments within us. Let's look at the subconscious mind. Because when we do that, we see that change is possible.
So if someone is really like ready to either learn more or do the work for themselves and get into it, whether it's for yourself, for a family member, for like what would you tell them to do?
Well, that's the beauty of what we're doing and the history that we have now. We've been doing this for 10 plus years. We have a lot of different ways for people to get help. I mean, the podcast is a free, easy way to listen and learn. I think for people that are looking for, and obviously the book, which is just now being translated into Spanish. Mm-hmm. So my guess is by the time people hear this, we will have a Spanish version of Mind Change. Yes, which is amazing. So we're trying to help more people. Italian's coming next. So those are low level, easy ways to kind of get in. I think for people who might be looking for a bit of a jump start, we've got, I think, give us a call. Let's chat. Let's do a consultation, free 20-minute consultation. That way we can hear what you're looking for, what your story is, and help direct you, because we have sessions, one-on-one private sessions. We have retreats. We have courses. We have all kinds of things for people. And so I think the good news is there's a lot of different options, but you don't need to figure those out yourself. We can help you do that. So give us a call. We will just go to mindchange.com, set up your consultation, your free consultation, and let's chat. We can talk about that.
Awesome.
So lots of different ways.
Well, thanks for the conversation. It was, had a lot of heat to it. A lot of, we'll see how everyone takes this, but hopefully it's with love and appreciation.
And curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the authority here. We're just asking. We run by a motto: if you ask better questions, you get better answers. So I think this is just maybe a better question to ask. But
all right.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
again. And thank all of you, our audience, for joining us once again on the Mind Change Podcast, where we are changing the world one mind at a time.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Mind Change Podcast. We hope that you found the insights and inspiration shared today valuable in your own journey of personal growth. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast, or if you're watching us on YouTube, please like and follow us there. And we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star rating and review. It has measurable impact on how well we're able to reach others and continue to produce more free content to share. But mostly, thank you for taking this time as an opportunity to invest in yourself. Until next time, let's keep changing the world one mind at a time.